Welcome to Why I'll Never Make It, a lighthearted podcast that takes a revealing look at a career in the entertainment industry, featuring stories and conversations with those on stage and backstage, on screen and behind the scenes. To keep up with all the guests and episodes, go to the website, winmepodcast.com. There you will find ways to follow and connect via Twitter and Instagram, as well as ways to support and donate to the podcast. I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, and this is Why I'll Never Make It. Happy Monday, everyone. I hope you made it through the St. Patrick's Day weekend, had some fun, maybe got a little hungover, but here we are on another Monday, and I'm so glad you're choosing to spend a little time with me here on the podcast. Today, I have with me the wonderful Ilana Levine on the show, who has had a long career in Broadway, television, and film. She starred as Lucy in the 1999 Broadway revival of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, and has appeared in television shows and films, including The Nanny Diaries, Law and Order, and the memorable Seinfeld episode, The Contest. But in 2016, she made a transition to hosting her own podcast as well that you might have heard of, Little Known Facts. So, in time for my birthday tomorrow, I had the wonderful gift of sitting down with her at the Jen Waldman Studios in Midtown Manhattan to talk about acting, auditioning, and what making it means to her. Ilana, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
So, why don't we just dig right in? For yourself, you've hit kind of all the markers of Broadway, of theater, of television, of film. Is there one that kind of draws you back more than the others?
You know, I think when you've had the great fortune, as I have, to do long-running shows, and some not long-running shows, but I've had a few that ran a really long time, and the experience of really being on something with a group of people, where you really create a family. It's not just a job, but you really are living with these people over months and months in a theater or on a set. That's a really extraordinary thing. So I would say the theater in particular kind of matches my desire to connect with people very deeply.
Yeah.
And you get to rehearse, and you get to make mistakes until you find the thing that's going to work. And film and television, which is very exciting. I mean, I grew up watching TV, right?
So
the idea,
yeah.
I wasn't Mormon, not Mormon, who lives in, I wasn't Amish, is what
I meant
to say.
Right, I was about to say Mennonite, but Amish.
Yeah. Exactly. Right. So, yeah, I feel like it's a huge thing when you get to do your first TV show, because you can't believe it. Like, if you don't grow up in a family that is in this business, it's just like, my first TV job was a soap opera. And I used to go home every day after school and watch soap operas with my friends. And so the idea that I was on one, it was all heady and crazy. So I would say all of it has a learning curve that's sort of thrilling. But I like to rehearse. And I love that in theater you have the opportunity, if you don't feel amazing about what happened on Tuesday, you get to go back and do it on Wednesday. And in film and television, whatever you do, your favorite take or the moment that you felt was like the most truthful, the editor really decides.
Right, that right? may or may not be the one
exactly.
they use.
Exactly, and yeah. it may be the back of your head at that point. You know, like real tears are coming and they're showing your co-star. You're like, wait, I was really crying. So, yeah. you know, there's less control. Theater, you own it.
I mean, right, it's you there,
it's
you. And you're saying the lines, you're singing the song, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And yeah,
the
you
final
have to deliver.
Version is yours. And once the director is gone, stage management obviously continues to give you notes, which is great. But at the end of the day, it's like it's yours and your scene partners.
And what does making it mean to you? What has that meant to you in your career?
I think that when you find yourself over and over again, getting to work on really incredible material with incredibly creative people and forming the artistic community that you've dreamed of when you originally started out and thought about wanting to become a performer, I feel like for me, that defines making it, getting to do what you love with people you admire and grow from.
And has that definition of making it adjusted or changed throughout the years?
You know, there have been really some really big ticket years where I certainly felt like, oh, I've made it. I'm getting paid a lot of money to be an actress.
Which certainly helps.
It makes you feel, I don't know, like you've the right to say you're a professional, right? Yeah. But the irony is that some of the things that paid me weren't always the most satisfying creatively, but obviously gave me a certain freedom to do things that I really wanted to do. But the way my career has worked, and I think what I'm learning as I talk to other people who've been around for more than 5 minutes, is that there were lots of times where it was going amazingly well, and then there were times where it wasn't. Like if you looked at my EKG, I wasn't dead, I wasn't flatlining, but there were big peaks and valleys. That has certainly been my story.
Yeah, and you've gotten a chance to talk to a lot of the people, both that you've worked with as well as on your podcast. And has there been like a theme that you've noticed through all the interviews and people that you've talked with?
Yeah, I mean, I would say every person to a person just felt like even if they had to do a million other things to pay the bills, their love was being creative. That was the thing that really inspired them each day to go out into the world, to create stories and to make stories and to create content that meant something to them. And so even if it meant, you know, Edie Falco is a perfect example. Like, Edie waitressed for a really long time, and when she got the pilot of Sopranos, she immediately used that money to put a down payment on an apartment with the assumption that she would never make that kind of money again. So at least with her one moment of having won the lottery, she'd have like a little crappy studio apartment somewhere and set herself up that way. When the show got picked up, it was the most shocking thing to her that she wouldn't go back to waiting tables. So her whole thing was like, I want to make stuff. I want to be a part of a play or whatever opportunities come to me. And the idea that, you know, she also got paid was just almost absurd, right? It's like the thing she loved to do. And her mom was a community theater actress, so it wasn't like she had lofty aspirations to be on Broadway or to be a big star. She just loved it.
She just wanted to do something she enjoyed.
She always loved being around the theater. So I would say to a person, it really is like, this is what I love to do, and I'm going to set a life up where I can do it in whatever way I can.
And speaking of that control, have you wanted to get behind the table and also direct, write, and produce your own?
So when I started out in the city, I was so lucky. One of the first plays I did was with a theater company called Naked Angels. And once I kind of became a part of that company, the great joy of it was that you sort of could bring any project you wanted and do lots of different jobs in that production. So there were certainly things that I got to direct, and I got to produce a Stephen Belber play called Tape with that company, and it actually went from New York to LA to London miraculously. Great, I guess I should have just been a producer.
That had quite a journey.
Exactly. Yeah. And then I produced, I don't know, Jen Westfeld had done a film called Kissing Jessica Stein. Mm-hmm. And then the next film that she did, which was sort of the continuation, was called Ira and Abby. And I produced that with her. I was in it, but I produced it. And to be able to be in a room and say, like, how about we cast Judith Light and Frances Conroy and, you know, all these people that I admired, to suddenly go, like, that's who we're going to have in our movie. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah. I mean, I know for me, that's kind of one of those tick-offs. You know, if you're
listing all these definitions of making it, like getting to work with these people that you've looked up to, like a Judith Light or anyone like that.
And she was one of the first people who came on my podcast, right? Like, so there's these relationships
right, I
that
saw
you make,
her,
and
like,
then
within the first few ones, yeah.
She legitimized me very quickly by coming on, yeah.
And with all of these guests, like, are most of them people you've worked with or have some relationship with?
Yes.
Or any of them people like, hey, I've heard of you, you've heard of me, we have connection?
I would say, because I've been doing this as long as I've been doing it, one of the lovely things about maturing is that I have basically gone through every company of every play that I've ever done over the past 25 years, from Charlie Brown to some Neil Simon plays, like Jason Alexander from Seinfeld, you know, Judith Light from that film. Basically, I've gone through my
your Rolodex.
iPhone contacts.
right. There's not even a Rolodex anymore. So yeah,
but
your contact
Celia
list.
Keenan-Bolger, who's a friend of mine, you know, she did it. She had a great time. And then she told her friend Jesse Tyler Ferguson to come on. I didn't know Jesse. So that's an example of, and then the minute I met him, Celia is such a like glorious human being that of course everyone she's recommended is also like the warmest, nicest, glorious person. So it has happened that way where, you know, or I do a lot of panels at BroadwayCon.
Right.
I host those or I'm on them, and that is literally like
a fishbowl.
Talk about shooting fish in a barrel. Like, so you meet everyone, and then you're like, hey, Leslie Margarita, do you want to come on? Sure. So I've met a lot of people
so fun.
That way.
She's so fun.
Inspiring, and her message is incredible. And yeah, so it's happened in all sorts of ways. Ben Platt and I did a play the year before he did Dear Evan Hansen.
Right,
so
before
suddenly,
he was Ben
Platt.
Yeah,
he was my Ben Platt. Now he's the universe's Ben Platt. So
it's so amazing along our journey of performing to see these people, like for example, with The Prom, Caitlin Kunin. She is the star, the teenager. And she's doing so wonderfully. And, you know, if you haven't seen it, please go see it. And I produced a one act like 8 years ago and cast her in it.
When she was a fetus.
When she was little bitty.
Yeah.
You know, she was playing the teenage daughter then
right.
as well.
Right.
And we've kept in touch over the years, but then to see like her finally like hit it big, it's like I was the proud father. It's like
totally.
I remember her. I cast her in this and this, and now she's doing this.
I remember one of the very first plays I did in New York, Lauren Ambrose, I was playing a teen, although I was in college at the time, and Lauren Ambrose played my little sister. And I adored her. And then she went back to fourth grade. And then I turn on the TV and there's this TV show about a funeral home. And I was like, that looks like if Lauren Ambrose had grown up. And there it was.
And what do you know?
There you know. And then there we are at My Fair Lady, and she sings too. So it's very cool to see the people who to start so young, like to be a child actor and to keep doing it and to kind of, you know, transition to adulthood in such a seamless, elegant way. She's a perfect example of someone who's been able to do that.
And in your own life, what was your childhood experience with theater and performing?
Going to the theater just as a way to celebrate everything wonderful that ever happened to anyone in our life. I grew up in New Jersey. So that's something I talk a lot about on my podcast with my guests, the difference between having access to seeing Broadway shows up close and personal
right.
versus watching YouTube clips or just seeing tours go through your town, which now are as good as the Broadway productions. But
absolutely.
I grew up in New Jersey, and proximity has a lot to do with why I ended up doing this professionally. But we would come. If there were a birthday or a graduation or whatever it was, my mom would always bring us to see a Broadway show. I don't know. I didn't know anybody who did it. There was just nothing about it that even sparked any idea that this would be something I would do. And
so what was that first moment that you stepped foot on stage?
Well, the first moment I stepped foot on stage was really as part of an acting class here in New York City at the Terry Schreiber Studios. I had a crush on a guy. Everything great in my life was born out of love.
Love, right.
Real or imagined. And I was getting a haircut, and this guy had a play at his station in the salon, and I realized I'd never seen just a play. I mean, I'd seen collections of plays in high school, but I'd never seen like a Samuel French edition
of the script itself.
Yeah, with all his lines highlighted. And I guess in a kind of flirty way, I must have picked up the play and was like reading it out loud. And he told me that night they had, once a month, you could audit a class for free at the Terry Schreiber Studios, like on, you know, the first Wednesday of the month.
Yeah.
And he was like, hey, I'm going to the studio tonight. Do you want to come and audit? And literally, my dad's an accountant, so I knew the word audit, but it meant like the IRS was coming to like...
You're like, whoa, I don't need all
that. I was so confused. But I was like, yeah, I'll audit. You know, I was like 19. And I never left. And I don't know, at that point, it certainly wasn't that I intended to become a professional actress, but I just had one of those, if it were a Disney movie, like angels would start singing and... It's like, oh, look, here are my people.
The sunshine came through the window, and it's like, this is it.
It was right here the whole time? Oh, my God, I was in the wrong room. Yeah. And people were doing, like, emotional recall exercises.
Oh,
and
right.
I did not know what was going on.
I'm sure it was a little overwhelming.
It was a little overwhelming. But I remember thinking, aside from being astonished at the way the teacher kind of coached people through these experiences, more than the beauty of that vulnerability that each artist was exhibiting was the support everyone in the room was giving them. Sort of this way in which everyone was, it's where I learned about criticism, right? Like find the positive first. Everyone was starting from this place of positivity. And only after they made the person feel that they'd accomplished great things would they talk about like maybe next time.
Right.
What if you worked on this or that? And then hearing the teacher talk about like, oh, what you just did, Jasper, you could think about like Summer and Smoke and how you can use that in the play. Like, it was like, what? Of course, I didn't know the language. But it turns out the way some people are really good at learning foreign languages, I had an ear for whatever this was. And it changed my whole life going to that studio. It made me want to go to college and major in theater, again, not knowing what that would mean after college. And then that was my first community of people. I went to school and an actor named John Benjamin Hickey was a senior at the time, and he has gone on to win Tonys and be, you know, but he was like my first friend at that school.
Wow.
Kind of took me under his wing. And it made me decide to go to college in New York City. I loved Fame growing up, the show.
Right, I remember
Fordham
watching
University,
the TV show.
Yes, was right by the Lincoln Center. That's literally why I chose where I went to college. It was like, oh, that's the opening credits from Fame. Like,
I want to go to there.
I did. And it turned out to be a great choice.
So as you moved forward, when did it come upon you like, oh, I can do this for a living. I'm now going to pursue and make it, whatever that's going to be.
So I was very fortunate. One of my teachers at Fordham University, at the Lincoln Center campus, was involved in a theater company, which no longer exists anymore, but incredible playwrights like Lanford Wilson and others were born and kind of curated their work in this think tank called Circle Repertory.
Right.
And so some of us were invited to be part of like a lab company there. I think I had to audition. I think you had to be invited to audition. I remember inviting my friend from acting class, Connie Shulman, who now plays Yoga Jones on Orange is the New Black. She auditioned with me and I got in and she didn't, and it was devastating that my friend didn't get in with me.
It's always so devastating.
And now she's super famous, so they were wrong.
But in those moments, we think so much of those devastating moments. Because for me, my biggest one came in junior high, where the high school was doing Sound of Music, but obviously they needed children. So they came to the junior high and looking for kids. And so I auditioned to be in the Sound of Music in the high school, and they chose this other guy. I mean, and I was kind of bratty about it too, because I didn't think he sang as good.
Sure,
and
he didn't.
And I was just so upset, and I would make little snide comments to him. I was so awful, because it meant everything. And because I didn't get it, I was devastated.
Of course. Rory O'Malley, who has also, we've kind of each interviewed each other for each other's podcasts, and his podcast is called Living the Dream.
Yes,
and
yes,
I
I've
love
heard
him
his.
So much, and go listen to Rory O'Malley. But he talks about kind of even being younger than you. I guess he was in elementary school, and he was big into community theater in his town, and he heard about an audition at like a bigger community theater. I may be misremembering, but basically he's like, I'm not going to tell anyone else, right? He was not going to tell people about it because he didn't want anyone else to get the part. And of course he got to the audition, and every little boy from his
They're
other...
They're all there, of course. Yes.
And he felt so awful about it, but there's that, he was like, when I think back to my childhood, that still is sort of one of those things. I was so ambitious that I didn't want to share information with other people. And we talked about like how great it is when that stuff happens early on, because he realized that doesn't feel good.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be that person. Neither of us, none of them ended up getting it anyway. So it didn't even matter, but just this idea. And I think those early messages really stick with you in terms of who do you want to be? How do I want to be in this community when there's this idea of there being a seat at the table for everyone, but it isn't always true that there's a seat at the table for everyone. But how do you manage all that and negotiate all that? And it starts really early. Those seeds are planted in terms of how am I going to be ambitious, which is totally not a bad word,
right?
But generous at the same time.
Yeah, it's finding that balance.
Yeah.
And I think, as you said, as we discover these lessons, both good and bad, along the way, we kind of figure out the kind of actor we want to be, the kind of just person we want to be in dealing with others. And so on your journey of that, what did you find was kind of holding you back or kind of keeping you from being the best actress or just being the best fellow performer that you could be?
First of all, to answer best actress... still working on that, right? It's a continuation.
It's a learning process.
Yeah, it's always like, it's exciting to be in a career. Not everything has this where it's not like you start in lower management and end up in upper management and then you're done, right? The exciting and hard part about being in the arts is that there's not like a clear ladder that you go up rung by rung and then you've made it. Like, for me, I went up a couple of rungs, I fell to the bottom, then I got to the top. Like, it is a very fluid sort of thing for most people.
Absolutely.
So I think the exciting thing is you're always learning. And so all you can do is be the best actress you are on any given day and hope that it pleases the people that, you know, the writer mostly.
Right.
For me, it's all about the writer. Am I who he or she imagined? And am I telling the story in the way that they had hoped? But I would say that meeting John Benjamin Hickey early on, like people who were just so talented, filled with integrity and warmth, my university, it was such a welcoming program. And now that I've had 140 guests on my show, and you know, not everybody feels that way. Not everyone's had that experience in their university theater program. You know, a lot of people feel like they were pigeonholed really early on, and it took them a very long time to shed that from their own thought about themselves and what they're capable of. You know, people often are cast as the star show after show after show in college. Most of them aren't even doing it anymore, right? There's this way in which you're like, well, Kelly's doing it, I'm never going to do it. And then you get out in the real world and it's all bets are off.
Yeah.
It's an even playing field.
You really start back at zero again. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, you go through high school, you get known there, start over again, college. And then you kind of build up, start over again. You move to New York or LA or just doing your community theater where you live. And it's all about kind of starting over again. And it, as you were saying, it really is, there's no ladder. There's no stair step to success. It's kind of this constant ebb and flow, just kind of a roller coaster. It really is.
But I would say that the thing that you hear, it's so cliche, like be nice to everyone, but it's really, really true. Like one of the first people I met when I got into that lab company, Circle Rep Lab, was a guy named Joe Mantello, right? So yeah. Joe Mantello, Google it. If you're in the theater.
He's done a few things.
Right, yeah. Like, so, and then a writer named Peter Hedges. And, you know, there were all these people at that time who were old, elder statesmen in the company, but... You know, you never know who's going to end up being in the position to hire you or to collaborate with you. And that was very lucky for me that early on I just met these people who were so talented and we liked each other. And then we were able to, you know, move on together or wait tables together, you know. And then the person I waited tables with became an assistant to the casting director who cast the really teeny parts on soap operas, the under fives. That's how I got my start in soaps, the bartender who left and, you know, assisted.
It's always the most random connections that sometimes
tipped the bartender really well because I was very generous. And then when he became the assistant, he brought me in.
He remembered.
Yeah.
Yes. So along that path, as you were kind of getting started and maybe even now, have there been moments where it's like, you know, maybe you hit that ground floor again and it just kind of stayed there a while and you're like, well, okay, I'm going to move on to something else. I don't know if I can continue to do this.
You know, the thing about theater or it's like every time you think you're out, they get you back in, right? Like one thing that I was really fortunate to be a part of is a theater company where I could always do work. This is different from getting paid to do work, but I always had a place to make things. That, you know, whenever I do master classes or I'm asked to teach, asked to come in and just talk about like the business part of all of this, it really is like find a place to get to do what you love to do that no one else has control of.
Yeah.
And so I would say even when I, you know, maybe had to go back to doing a money job, I always had a place to do the theater.
Yeah.
And that, so I didn't have to make that decision. I guess to answer that, it wasn't like I set up my life that I can only act or do something else.
Yeah.
I set up my life that those things intersected all the time. And I would find, you know, so I produced a movie or produced a play. Like I found ways to be around it. Some people are tortured by it. Some people, it's too painful to not be doing the thing.
Yeah.
And that was never me. I was always interested in every aspect. It's not like I grew up like, I'm going to be an actress when I grow up. I just happened into it. And so every job on every set is equally fascinating to me.
Yeah, it's that old thing of that old saying of, you know, if you could do anything else, well, then go do it because then acting's not for you. And I think that really limits what a person can do and who they can be whenever you say that. Because, yes, as you discovered, theater and just performing, producing, whatever creative outlet you found was something that you enjoyed and you pursued those in addition to all the other money-making jobs or other things along the way. And I think it's so important that we have that well-roundedness.
I also am like a squirrel. When I do have the great fortune of a paycheck, I am not, I'm very like, I hoard those acorns and I, I'm not frivolous. It's not to say that I don't get excited and maybe like there's a nice purchase of some kind.
Of course.
But I have always felt like we are gypsies and who knows when, you know, we're going to have to pack up our tent and move it along. So,
yeah, I think that's one of the biggest things that I learned from when I finally did my first tour. It actually taught me a couple of things back to what we were saying.
What was your first tour?
It was The Addams Family.
Uh-huh.
And so doing that taught me two things. One that we were talking about before about being nice to people because they were looking for people that could be around each other 24/7, not just sing and act and dance, but actually be real human beings and friends and, you know, colleagues that can work together in, you know, in bad
everywhere.
Weather, in good weather, in
big
in,
towns,
in
small
shitty
towns.
Venues, whatever it was.
Yeah.
So that really taught me that, my attitude and how I present myself is just as important as hitting that high note.
And your reputation, you know, precedes you. So I feel like, especially in those tours, right? Like, people talk, mm-hmm. and if somebody's a jerk, they're not. There's a lot of talented people out there, so you're going to be an asshole. You better be irreplaceable. You better be the only one who can do what you're doing.
Because I was surprised what makes it onto those show notes that stage managers and company managers write that go out to all the producers and casting directors. Yeah, I mean, anything can be in those notes, and you never know. But the second thing, as we were mentioning, is that kind of shoring up money. It's like, oh, I'm making money right now, so I started investing. I started saving. I started because I don't know when my drought is going to happen.
When we did You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, before we came to New York, I remember Kristen Chenoweth and Kim Grigsby, who was our musical director, would room together, as we went from hotel. And I was like, would never have even occurred to me. Now, I had never done a tour before. This was my one musical. That wasn't my life. But that was so... By the way, after Charlie Brown, Kristen Chenoweth never had to share a room with anybody ever again, other than those she wanted to.
Yeah.
But I remember I learned that from them. Like, find someone who you can even not just be on the road with, share a room with.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that we paid for, I guess we did. I guess we were given an allotment. I was trying to think, did they not pay for our hotel room?
Yeah, I'm not sure what it was back then, but I know when I was on tour with the Addams Family, it was you're given a certain allotment per week,
right.
And then you can use
and
that.
And you can choose which hotel to, there were tiers of housing and things like that. Yeah. Anyway, maybe they just really liked each other.
Yeah, yeah. and again, it is a good way to save money because then you're splitting the cost of the room. So I mean,
maybe Grigsby gave her some special notes and that's why she won the Tony.
Right?
That
see?
Must be
it's all see it's all these little tricks that you have to figure out.
Share the room with a conductor on
there
the road.
You go.
Exactly.
Right? Well, I mean, and I'm sure that you've found this out, that there are certain people within the theater, within the production, that you never want to piss off. For me, I discovered it was sound and costumes. Those are the two people that you want to have a good relationship with because you want to sound good
and look pretty.
Yeah.
You don't want them turning your mic off.
Right. It's like, oh, yeah, I don't know what happened.
Did your solo not come out? Weird.
Could people not hear you?
Good advice. Little known fact.
Right. So when it comes to performing for stage and screen, how have you blended those two? Because, certainly in a lot of classes we hear about, there's this one technique for stage, one technique for camera. How have you found a blending of those?
It's such an interesting thing. It's so hard to be articulate about this stuff because really it's just, you have to experience it. It's why people take on camera classes, right? So they can really see the
really
idea of
different.
Oh, the camera sees into your eyes and does it? Does it see into your brain? I would say that really the difference is the distance between the audience that you're trying to reach, right? So when you're doing a play in a big house, your job is for the people in the third mezzanine to be able to experience the play fully.
Right.
Whereas that work is done for you by the camera. So it's really the intentions are the same and the work is the same and all the homework you do on the script is exactly the same. But you don't have to reach the very back of the theater. And I think it's modulating your performance for the size of the room you're doing it in, almost. I don't know if that makes sense. It's hard to be articulate about it.
No, I was just going to say, as you were saying, it really is an experiential thing. Like being on stage or being in front of a camera.
But then a sitcom, like Seinfeld that you mentioned earlier, exactly like being in a play. It's you have to, there's laugh lines and there's a rhythm and you hold for laughs. I mean, it really, there are certain televised things that you do on film that feel exactly the same.
Especially
being
with
in
that
a big
live
play.
Audience.
Yeah. So there is less delineation in that way. But it's really nice to know that you can just be in the moment and not have to add larger gestures so that everyone, gets it in the back row. There is something really nice about the intimacy of a camera.
Right.
And the camera's just another scene partner. Like, that's all. It's just one more. It's like another set of eyes. You're looking into your co-star's eyes. You're looking into the camera's eyes. It's the same. Yeah. I guess that's how I think of it. And, you know, it's not like you're talking to Julianne Moore, who's done 22 films. I've done a few films.
Right.
But that's been my... And I also just feel like, yeah, like there's no right or wrong way to do anything. And you just hope that whatever medium you're working in, there's a director who is able to take it in and help. Like, you're not alone. There's a director.
Yeah.
You know, like there's people to help.
So with these auditions, do you sometimes, as actors, we certainly judge ourselves on our last audition. We judge ourselves, you know, in the moment. We're like reading the lines and we're judging, oh, this is going well, or oh, why am I saying? Do you still have those voices inside you?
Oh my God, of course. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. I was just thinking the other day, like, oh my God, how long have I been doing this? And I'm still feeling like I have to, like, give myself emotional rewards. Like, okay, you're going to go to Telsey's office. And that's a New York City casting director. And then as soon as we're done, we're going to, like, go to H&M. And we're going to get a shirt. So just go in.
The smallest thing.
Yes, like, I literally, like a child actor who doesn't want to do it. And the mother's like, I'll buy you a lollipop if you just do it. Like,
we'll
literally,
go get pizza after.
It's all going to be over in 10 minutes. Like, all I'm asking you to do, Alana, I literally talk to myself in third person, like, I'm just going to ask you to go in. We're going to do it. We're going to go out. Like, literally, I've been doing the same things. But I remember early on, there's a guy named Fisher Stevens who was like a, you know, worked all the time when I was first starting, and now he's producing extraordinary films. And I remember, I guess it was Fisher who told me, like, every time he walked into the room, he pretended that he was about to go on Letterman. Like, when he, that energy, like, I'm going on Letterman, and I'm going to tell Letterman about this movie I just did. And I'm going to just tell him the scene. Like, he just would come, you know, and I was like, wow. And I tried that a couple of times. And I was like, all right, not that's not my thing. But there was something about, like, whatever you need to do, obviously you need to prepare and know your lines and warm up vocally if you're about to sing.
But there is that emotional element, which I think what he was trying to tap into with
He's
that.
He's like, I'm the star. I'm going in on Letterman, and I'm just telling them about this play called The Addams Family.
Right.
Right? And I thought, it's just so funny, like, whatever works. And there's been elements of all sorts of things like that that I've used to, you know, psych myself up for the experience, from that to, you know, thinking of it as a rehearsal.
Right, yeah.
Right? Rather, right. Like, the thing that I remember, I think my friend Talia Balsam just said it, and she's someone, her mom is Joyce Van Patten, and her father was Martin Balsam. Like, she, Dick Van Patten is her uncle, and Tim Van Patten, you know, all these people, unlike my accounting family, she comes from a, and it really was like, you're just going in and giving them your take on it. So there's no right or wrong. It's just...
Which is so important, because we as actors think there's only one right.
Right.
And we have to go in and deliver that, or we've
messed
up. You
can't guess what it is.
I know. Yeah, there's no way.
I was just at a thing yesterday where Brian Stokes Mitchell told a story about literally the person who got it fit into the costume of the person they were replacing.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. There's no way the 25 actresses who went in that day had any idea that they were immediately... non-candidates because of their height or their weight, like just things they have zero control over.
Yeah.
Now, would it have been nice if the breakdown said 5'6", 120, you know?
Must be.
Right,
yes.
And obviously they can't do that, but they don't know that they didn't get it because literally they wouldn't fit the costume. So there's so many things that we don't know, which is why... all you can do is what I do, which is, and this is, I'm sorry to say, I am a recycler, but I literally put my sides, like, I throw them away the minute,
you toss them.
Yeah. It's done. I did it. It felt great. I just shot the scene and now I'm done. And if they want me to come do it again, I'll print it again.
I feel awful
just from an environmental perspective, but psychologically, nothing makes me happier than to have to reprint the side.
No, there is something to be said for kind of cleansing yourself, for putting like, okay, stop. That's pushed aside. I did my work. Moving on.
Yeah. I did it.
Yeah, because I took a class with Joanna Gleason, and one of the nuggets that I took from that, probably the best thing she, you know, that I took from it, was that she said, you're going to have crappy auditions, and so give yourself 20 minutes to beat yourself up, to say horrible things, to be like, what the, you know, and go through that, and then be done.
Set a timer.
Right. Like, you have 20 minutes to just, like, be sad, be angry, be disappointed, and then you're done. Get on with your day.
Well, that is easier said than done.
Much easier.
But what a great thing to aspire to.
Yeah, it is something. Because
I love her.
Yeah, because I don't know about you, but there's still like that audition 3 years ago that some random thing will pop it into my brain and be like, oh yeah, I didn't get that audition. I didn't get that. Because I messed up in there. And then you replay, you remember that whole audition and what you did wrong.
But the thing that's so awesome is that, you know, I mean, I feel like at this point, I'll have a conversation with that person who I auditioned for, and they're like, oh my God, you were amazing. We already had an offer out. Like, you're like, oh, Sarah Jessica, but oh, okay. So that thing that you've been holding on to, like, by the way, you were amazing. And you know, like, I've now produced enough and directed enough where I've had the experience of being on the other side of the table. And I will see someone beating themselves up, or you see that moment where they think they've not accomplished what they set out to do.
Yeah.
By the way, they weren't. They weren't until they told me they were, right? Like, I actually thought they were amazing. I don't know what they had expected of themselves. And so that's the other thing I learned from having the great, by the way, be readers. Whoever's listening, if you ever get a chance to be a reader in an audition, I did that early on a lot. It was the most illuminating because it really is about coming in with an openness. Look, sometimes you get the thing on Tuesday and you're only so prepared for Wednesday, right? Like life happens.
Yeah.
We all know that. So don't come in and start telling everybody like, I just got it. Guess what? Everybody just got it.
Right. We know. We emailed it to you. We remember.
We as casting directors just got the script too. We're frustrated.
Yeah.
Right? But like there really is this amazing thing you see where everyone is kind of amazing until they decide they're not. And that changes and shifts like the whole energy of the room. So I have certainly learned whatever's going on inside of me, do not share that with anyone.
I've had two auditions where that happened, and it really is. It like demoralizes you, but I can only imagine what it does to the person behind the table because, you know, yeah, we're all not going to be 100% every day, but at the same time, just do it, even your 80%, and then get out.
Yeah.
I don't need to comment.
Nope.
I actually said shit in an audition one time because I messed up the side.
Right.
And then the director, Warren Carlyle, had me do it over again. And I was just like, I mean, I look back on that, I'm going, what was the matter with me?
But that's the other thing. Like what you were just being a human being.
Yeah.
That's all. And you know what? That human being at that moment, at that time, was bummed out that something he'd worked really hard on, that you flubbed the line.
Yeah.
You were bummed about that. What are you going to do?
Right,
nothing.
Right.
Except remember it 4 years later and be like, I said shit at the thing. I know. It's funny.
Yeah. If I ever meet him again, he'll be like,
nothing.
Him, he won't remember at all.
No. What if he does? He's like, I remember you.
Yes.
You cursed.
Right. Remember you said
you would have gotten it, except you said that
until
one
you said
word.
Shit, I know. And then I couldn't.
It's also stupid, isn't it? It's so stupid.
I know that the things that we go, but and so you mentioned that you've been behind the table directing, and so how has that been? You know, now working with actors, you know, having been one yourself and still one yourself.
I love it. I love it. I mean, I really do. I feel like, A, what a relief, right? It is, let me just say this, it's so much better on that side.
I mean, I'm sure directors have their own pressures, but Not as much as the actor you would say?
Just to find the person, right? There's pressure on you to find the right person because, as we know, 90% of what makes a successful anything is casting the right people. So obviously, the pressure is to do well by the piece.
Right.
But no, it's absolutely from not worrying about what you look like to not worrying about saying a bad word because you're not feeling good. For me, it's such a reminder about the beauty and the humanity of what actors do, right? Like it just, the great news is, by the way, I'm not a director, so it's not like this is my new calling and I do it all the time, but it really is a wonderful thing to do everything you can to give someone space to be wonderful. The thing that I've loved about producing or doing anything in this career besides acting is just like, what do you need to be the best you can be? Right? So for every department, you're doing costumes, how can I help? You're doing craft services. What can I go to Costco for you?
Yeah.
Like, how do you create a room? And that's, to me, the one thing that's unforgivable. Anyone who doesn't create an audition room where everyone, for the time that they're in that room, feels 100% respected, appreciated, and welcomed to the party.
Yeah.
Like, no.
It really is amazing how many casting directors, and it's not a lot, but there are just a few that are buried into their computer or that they're chit-chatting with the person next to them. And I get that business has to go on, but like, I'm just here for 60, 90 seconds. Can I just have your attention, please?
Of course. And it's rare that those things happen.
Right.
I mean, it is rare that you're in a room with casting directors who you're like, I'm sorry, do you hate actors? I feel like you're...
am I imposing? Should I walk out and come back in?
But humor is just such a great icebreaker. And if you're lucky enough to just be funny, have a natural ability to be funny, it really is a great asset, both in terms of how you get over things, but also just having... Oh my God, all I do is laugh at myself. That's all I can do. Like, I will literally walk out going, oh my God. Well, you just did that. That's hilarious.
That happened.
Let's go to H&M.
I love that. I may have to steal that H&M idea. I love that.
Because for like 10 bucks,
right, you can get yourself for $9.99, I can just forget about
that's
what I just did. And you know what? And even if you don't buy anything, just the act of like looking around, just shopping.
Just
you know,
knowing that there's something
for me,
on the other
for
side.
For me, it's food. Like having, you know, that one or two things that always make me happy no matter what's going on. I tend to go for food. You know, if I've had a really crappy day, it's like, damn it, I'm going to go get some pizza or whatever it is. Yeah. It just changes my mood.
Yeah.
So as you go forward, you've mentioned you've cast a wide net, you know, producing and directing and acting. And what do you see going forward for yourself? Like what is it that keeps you here and
I
keep going?
I think that this podcast, which really came out of left field for me, I always loved, it's funny, I've had a chance to do a few radio plays in my life, just these really interesting experiences kind of working with a mic, and I've done a lot of voiceover and some books on tape, and I always really loved the audio experience and telling stories in that way. And by the way, listener, we're right next to an acting class. If you hear stuff, it's awesome.
Right.
It's
the Jim Waldman Studios, it's an active studio.
Yes, it's great. It's so real. I guess the conversations that I've been having, these kind of creative conversations about art and struggle and process, have now entered this new phase with, aside from the podcast, I'm doing a lot of live events, which are incredibly satisfying and are kind of moving the podcast back onto the stage in some weird way.
Right. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Because like some of the podcasts that I listen to are now having like stage events. They're going on tour.
Yeah.
You know, kind of thing.
Yeah. And so that's been happening to my podcast. And if you listen, you can hear when, you know, we're not pretending they're not live and there's audience participation. So that's been exciting to kind of move it back onto the stage. And I do a series of them at the Atlantic Theater Company in New York City, which is one of the first theaters I ever worked at when I came to New York. So it's kind of coming full circle. I've always been someone who just happily says yes to the things that are presented to me, if they feel safe financially, physically, and emotionally. And so right now, having conversations with people who I am really inspired by and getting to share those people globally, because you can listen to a podcast, you know,
anywhere,
is really wonderful. And that's where I am right now. It's been incredibly satisfying, and I'm sure I will do another play, and I'm sure I'll do, you know, episodes of TV shows that shoot in New York, but I have kids, and it's really wonderful having found something that I can control the hours, and that's right. What this podcast has afforded me, and...
Because I assume in the beginning it was difficult to balance that family life with
the
career.
Yeah, I mean, I did a play, you know, I love doing plays, but you are out every night. And so that was painful. Not painful enough not to do it, because I also really loved it and loved doing it. But so far I've been able to find ways to kind of do both. And by the way, as much as it was hard for me to be away from them, for your kids to come see you in a play, it's a pretty cool thing.
It must be a thrill.
Yeah, it is. So anyway.
Yeah. Because whenever I have family come, it kind of pumps up your performance that night. You're on a different level. And so you just kind of bring different things. And
also, like, it's one thing they hear about it, but like, that, you know, sometimes we do things they can't see, like they're not appropriate. You know, my husband's done 17 movies and TV shows that were like, when you're older, right?
Right.
And then they sneak and see them anyway. Yeah. I wasn't going to let my kids watch Seinfeld, you know, because the contest is all about the contest.
Right.
And then my daughter and I are on an airplane and I see her like, you know how you can move the screen a little bit? Like, so it's facing.
Yeah.
And she's like, Mom, I just watched Seinfeld. So she saw it on the plane. And I was right there next to her and I didn't even notice. I was probably watching The Notebook for the 20th time.
Right.
So, yeah, she saw it.
What is it that you do watch for, you know, that either inspires you or that is like your comfort?
This is really crazy, but I just started, with all the stuff that's out there, I've been watching Downton Abbey again. I don't know why.
Right.
I went to an exhibit recently. They had like the Downton Abbey exhibit of all the clothes and sort of all of the period stuff. And that is something, I mean, I watch a tremendous amount of television. I can't pretend I don't. But
no,
I'm
the same way. And I don't know if it's the same for you, but there's something about finding a family, finding that group of people that you relate to. It's like your home on screen kind of thing.
And in this culture right now, I don't know, there's something very, I mean, I watch Homeland. I watch a lot of shows that go on hiatus and then come back. I watch The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. I mean, I've been watching.
I just started watching that. Oh, my gosh. I loved it. Binged it. It was
great.
Yes.
And so I finished it, and then I was like, oh, there's a British show called Catastrophe that I love, also on hiatus. So for some reason, I was on Amazon or something, and Downton popped up. And so I was like, oh.
Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah. Yeah. It's also nice to go back to those things that you've seen before and remember those little moments or
but
the
I love
scenes.
British. Yeah. I mean, The Crown. Have you been watching The Crown? I love
that. I've heard it's wonderful, but no, I've yet
it's
to
great.
See that.
So I've been really binge watching a lot of also British content.
Yeah. 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 Because that really is like, I mean, really is foreign to us. A lot of that, either a period piece or just, you know, what it's like to live in London or Yorkshire or wherever they are.
I just interviewed Harry Haddon Payton, who plays Henry Higgins in My Fair Lady on Broadway right now, and he'd been on Downton Abbey and The Crown and all these British shows, and I found out that Sarah, the Duchess of York, Fergie, is his godmother, and I literally was like, I'm sorry, we're going to get to My Fair Lady in a minute.
Wait, but hold that thought.
I'm obsessed. I was like, I know you must think it's crazy, but we are quite obsessed over here with those.
So then is he like part royal now?
No, it turns out, I guess he is. It turns out his mom and Fergie like worked in a store together before she met Prince Andrew. So it wasn't that he was sort of, you know, a descendant of the Spencers, but that his mom's like best friend married. It's kind of like if Meghan Markle's best friend, you know, suddenly
yeah, and then all
godparent
of a sudden it's like,
to her.
Oh, right.
But literally, I was like, what is wrong with me? It was like Real Housewives of London. Like, I was like, we're going to get to, yes, your greatest Henry Higgins.
Right. I'm sure you have a beautiful voice. But back to this godparent thing. What is going on there?
But it's really fun hearing him kind of talk about that world and what it was like. And Beatrice and Eugenie had come to see the show and whatever. I'm still talking about it.
Well, no, it is kind of crazy. Like, because the theater and I assume even in the TV world, it's a very small little bubble.
Yeah.
And it's like that 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. You know, how many people can you
so get now away? I'm pretty close to Sarah,
right,
to Fergie, because Harry and I are good friends now. So what do you want to know?
Well,
I got it all there.
you know all. You're in with the royals
I'm
now.
I'm so there.
Well, and I just found out I'm now one. Okay, so if you know someone who knows someone, then that's 2 degrees.
Or
is that one?
So.
Is that the
I
one degree?
I did not know there was going to be math. So
right. So let's just go. I found out though that I'm one person away, let's put it that way, from Jonathan Larson of Rent. I did not know this until just recently. I worked with a lyricist who I just found out was like one of his best friends before Jonathan Larson wrote Rent and was who he was. Like, they were best friends, and I didn't even know this. I'm like, well, I worked with that writer who worked and
Today's
was best
his
friends
birthday.
With.
Today's Jonathan Larson's birthday.
That's right.
As we
That's
record right. this. Yeah.
Yeah.
It all connects.
Worlds collide.
Exactly. I wonder if it's Fergie's birthday.
You know, somewhere.
I bet it is.
Somewhere a royal is having a birthday.
I agree.
Happy birthday, royal.
There you go.
Yeah. Alana, thank you so much for joining me. This has been just a hoot to have you on. And thank you so much for sharing your story.
Of course. It was my pleasure.
As always, thank you for joining me on this episode, and don't forget to subscribe and review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Currently, this podcast has 5 stars, which I am so grateful for. And if you enjoy listening to these stories and interviews as much as I love being a part of them, then consider going to the website winmepodcast.com and making a donation to help further these conversations. Until next time, keep making it. And I'll see you then. Hey Siri, subscribe to Why I'll Never Make It podcast.
Just to confirm, would you like to subscribe to the podcast Why I'll Never Make It by Patrick Oliver Jones?
Yes.
Okay, I've subscribed you.